From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
All I could do was to put out top secret documents of history showing every previous president acted the way I claim Nixon is acting.
That was Pentagon Papers leaker Daniel Ellsberg referring to his release of top secret documents in the early 1970s that showed a true history of U.S. involvement in Vietnam, which Ellsberg said contradicted what Nixon intended to do going forward at that time.
Read this and see if you don't think you should look very closely at what Nixon is doing. Challenge him. Have hearings. Call witnesses. Find out whether he really means to get out.
A recent release of documents from that period showed that there was a much deeper game being played, which included targeting Ellsberg and others like him directly. This includes anti-war protesters in general, some of whom had been shot and killed by the government. One such victim was Allison Krauss, who was shot and killed at Kent State by the Ohio National Guard on May 4th, 1970. That date remains an important date in U.S. history, but the events that transpired on May 4th, 1970 have never been thoroughly examined. Eight of the Ohio National Guardsmen who opened fire on protesters were indicted by a grand jury, but that case was later dismissed. The findings of an investigation of the Ohio National Guard have never been publicized, and more importantly, there's never been a public inquiry to hear, record, and preserve the stories of those who were directly impacted by Kent State, including eyewitnesses. Laurel Krauss is the sister of Allison Krauss, and she heads the Kent State Truth Tribunal. We discussed with her what the implications were for Kent State of the expose of the Nixon administration's declaration of war on Ellsberg and other anti-war protesters.
At the Kent State Truth Tribunal, we interviewed original participants and witnesses of the Kent State massacre, and a common thread throughout was how the government was targeting protesters. They called them long hairs in this new report. Mm. And they were basically people that were against the war, and they were protesting.
Yeah, so the things that were just released by, I guess, NBC FOIL request. One is a memorandum dated June 5th, 1975. It's entitled Investigation into the Assault on Anti-War Demonstrators on the Capitol Steps on May 3rd, 1972. That's a day shy of the second anniversary of your sister's murder. And it was called murder, by the way, by the United States government. You wrangled that out of them at the UN Human Rights Committee in Geneva.
Well, that happened a lot later. We did that on the 44th year after the Kent State massacre, which was May 4th, 1970. And we took Kent State to the UN before the UN Human Rights Committee. And it was the U.S. Fourth Periodic Review. They were overseeing the 5 years of United States activity and how it related to human rights. And a lot of groups were there. We were one of them, the Kent State Truth Tribunal. During that period, the Department of Justice responded and said, in May 1970, four students were killed, were murdered.
Hmm. The M word. And so this, speaking of M words, the memorandum that we just referenced from 1975, it says the anti-war demonstration in question, which was investigating an assault on anti-war demonstrators on the west steps of the Capitol on May 3rd of 72, allegedly perpetrated by Bernard Barker and a group of nine Miamians. I guess those are people from Miami. It says the anti-war demonstration in question had been billed as a drama liturgy on the air war and featured an array of anti-war notables, that's how they put it, including Daniel Ellsberg, William Kunstler, Sister Elizabeth McAllister, and Judy Collins. It says that it coincided with the public viewing of former FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover's coffin in the rotunda of the Capitol, a short sight from the demonstration. So Maybe give us a little bit of what you heard in the report about what happened that day.
Well, it's kind of shocking to see this so many years later, something we really didn't have any access to until just now, where it's, you know, this Watergate investigation uncovered direct intention to beat up, harm, and harass what they call notables, anti-war notables. This was a real important point that was totally glossed over and never revealed to the public. Although I know that Daniel Ellsberg was really trying to bring it to the fore, just like his Pentagon Papers. And it was shocking to read this so many years later. Here we are 47 years later, and we're finally getting the real skinny on what was going on. And there was absolute targeting of anyone that was against the Vietnam War. And they were going to shut them up, they were going to beat them up, and they were going to try to put them in jail. And, you know, even more so, they were going to kill. Yeah. And that's what happened to my sister.
So they killed four there, and then about a week and a half later was Jackson State.
Jackson State happened 10 days later, right. and they killed two men, and it's said that there were 14 more, but they don't have an accurate count on the Jackson State woundings.
Mm-mm. You know, there was an environment where if you were an anti-war demonstrator, you were being intimidated. I remember in New York City, they had construction workers beating up protesters, and this was encouraged in the public domain, basically. It was part of the culture.
That was actually Nixon planned. That was the Hard Hat Riot that happened shortly after Kent State, and it was a planned event where right wing hard hats were sent to a protest. People were mourning the Kent State massacre and the Jackson State massacre, and they were protesting. They gathered together to feel this pain together in New York City. It was a pretty large protest, and Nixon sent in henchmen, right, which were the hard hats to disrupt the trial. There was a lot of injury in that.
There was, yes.
They received medals. The men that did the hard hats that did this, they got commendations for doing such a good job at this hard hat riot.
There were so many contradictions nested within this whole period, the things that were happening in this whole period. But one of them is that Nixon was prosecuting this, set of actions against Ellsberg that rested on his leaking the Pentagon Papers, which in fact really didn't deal with Nixon at all. It dealt with the U.S. involvement in Vietnam up to the point that Nixon became president. So, Nixon was a Republican, Johnson was a Democrat, Kennedy was a Democrat, and then Nixon was a vice president, of course, for Eisenhower, so there's some role in there. But, the bulk of it was something he could have used as a political weapon. And he had run, by the way, promising that he had a secret plan to end the Vietnam War. So, Ellsberg's argument was, look, the U.S. government's been lying through their teeth from the beginning. Most likely this guy's lying, too. That was the argument. But Nixon could have easily said, well, no, they were lying. I'm going to solve the problem. And instead, he attacked Ellsberg aggressively.
And that makes me consider a whole bunch of different elements. Now, if it wasn't Nixon being shown to be at fault in the Pentagon Papers, who really was damaged by the Pentagon Papers? Well, let's look at this. Mm. It was the Pentagon.
Right. Okay. Of course.
They were the ones that were holding the bag, so to say. And they just couldn't allow the Pentagon Papers to be exposed and published and read by everyone. And Nixon was their figurehead to try to make it so that he was going to be targeted for the rest of his life for exposing this information.
Mm. One of the interesting things in this memo also, the first significant evidence in this investigation was provided by Jeb Magruder in an interview on July 26, 1973. He said that Charles Colson telephoned him prior to the demonstration requesting Magruder to instruct Ken Reitz, who was a chair of a youth group, to organize a counter-demonstration with Nixon youth volunteers and to recruit people to protect these counter-demonstrators. Magruder contacts Liddy, that says in G. Gordon Liddy, for guards, and Liddy in turn contacts Colson. These are all the players in the Watergate, by the way, the indicted co-conspirators. Their hands are all over this, and we now find out, which should have been evident 50 years ago, 45 years ago, they were targeting Ellsberg. They targeted student protesters. They were behind the murder of the students in both Kent State and Jackson State, and a whole bunch of other ugly stuff was being run by the government. And we have the COINTELPRO papers to prove that as well. Yet, you know, this is, it's news that we've learned this today because it's been hidden for so long. Anyway, so an attorney that you've been working with has brought an action seeking to enforce a FOIL request looking for documents that have to do in particular with the shootings at Kent State, with new evidence that has, or really a new analysis of evidence that's existed, that demonstrates the, you know, the clearly the hand of the government in the shooting of the students at Kent State. The government's been stonewalling. That was true in the Obama administration. It continues during the Trump administration. And we have some of those details in our conversation with Michael. But maybe you could tell us a little bit about what that case is about.
Well, but first, I'd like to just comment about how it's interesting that the FOIAs are now breaking this new information out. And thank goodness for that. FOIA is a really important tool. And we've hit some major pay dirt with our recent FOIA action that Michael Kuzma, a lawyer who's been pursuing information related to the Kent State massacre, specifically into Terry Norman, who has been highlighted as a as alleged, he's an agent provocateur. He is believed to have fired the first shot at Kent State on May 4th, 1970, and he was also a paid FBI informant at the time that he was active at Kent State.
And as it turned out, he had a gun that, as it turned out, was provided him by some police officers. And as it turned out, it appears that that gun was the first gun fired. And the interviews that were taken in the aftermath of the shootings there of National Guards and others said that, well, we heard gunshots and responded to that. In addition, new acoustic evidence of an old recording made that day by a student from the second floor of one of the nearby buildings, clearly you heard an order to fire, which previously had been denied by the government all the way through.
You mentioned stonewalling earlier, and and basically it's just you know, fundamental to our government that they stonewall all truth related to these major events that affects all of us. We're not allowed to know the truth of any of this, and now the FOIAs, thank goodness, they're bringing it forward. But we have to take a look at what is. How do we dismantle the stonewalling in our government so that we can actually get some truth, you know, as it's happening, maybe instead of 50 years later? And when it comes out 50 years later, it gets buried, too.
Yeah, again, that's right. You're right. So I spoke with Michael about the case, and we're going to listen to that, and then we'll be back. Again, this is Michael Kuzma, who is the plaintiff in a lawsuit against the U.S. government seeking release of some FOIA information with respect to the Kent State massacre. Could you describe what this action is about, this lawsuit, the venue, and what you're seeking to accomplish in court, and then what the purpose of that is with respect to the entire question of what happened at Kent State?
Yes, on May 4th, 2016, we filed a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of New York, and it was a lawsuit that was brought under the Federal Freedom of Information Act. for records relating to Terrence B. Norman, more commonly known as Terry Norman. And I sought records from the FBI relating to his involvement in the May 4th, 1970 Kent State shootings, where four students were killed by Ohio National Guardsmen and nine others were wounded.
Okay, so we're working on the FBI informant, alleged FBI informant. And we also have this acoustic evidence that supports the, you know, the allegation that he fired first, and also that picked up somebody issuing a fire order to the National Guard.
Correct. So, I would also note that there's a, with the records, after I brought the lawsuit this past January 2017, the FBI changed its position, or the government changed its position, and they did release 171 pages in full or in part. And it's interesting to see that the gun that Terry Norman had on May 4th, 1970, actually had been purchased by a police officer from the Akron, Ohio Police Department. So he has a gun supplied by the police department. The other thing is, and these documents are all on a website called KentStateTerryNorman.com. Once again, it's KentStateTerryNorman, all one word, .com. But the other thing that's pretty fascinating is the FBI, there was an agent on campus May 3rd through May 4th, and he actually encountered Norman either late on May 3rd or very early on May 4th. But, of course, the FBI claims that was just a chance meeting. So, but the FBI also provided Terry Norman with film. There's actually pictures of Norman. You'll find it on the website, but he had a gas mask and a camera and, of course, the gun. But he would get film from the FBI. He would provide his photos to the campus police, and then they, in turn, would make the prints available to the FBI.
So let's say you have at some point enough evidence to demonstrate conclusively that Terry Norman was A, an FBI agent, B, was given a gun by local police in Akron, see, that gun was fired, and then that there was a fire order issued by the commander or someone in command of the Ohio National Guard. You've established essentially a case of state agency in the killing of four people on May 4th, 1970 at Kent State.
That's correct.
So then what?
Well, when Dennis Kucinich was a member of Congress, he was a representative in and around Cleveland. He was pushing really hard, and Kucinich, of course, the Governor Kasich and the Ohio legislature redistricted Dennis, where he's no longer the a member of the House. I think you could put, you can basically, all you can do now, given what's happening with American politics, is to put the public spotlight on what happened. I'm not overly optimistic right. that the Sessions Justice Department would take action on this, but you never know.
And that you also have on the record Del Corso, who was the National Guard's top general, releasing a public statement claiming that Norman had admitted firing four shots at the demonstrators.
That's, well, and then there's that footage, which there's a link on the webpage that shows Norman with the Kent State detective and another Kent State police officer, where he turned over the gun. And there's National Guardsmen, but it was clear the gun was fired in spite of the fact that the detective said that there was the gun hadn't been fired. Ultimately, that gun ended up back at Smith & Wesson. They were ready to
smelt it.
And it was only after Senator Birch Bayh made some inquiries that the FBI tracked the gun down and was able to get it back. But it's incredible that this critical piece of evidence ended up back with Smith and Wesson. And that, too, is detailed in the documents that were released than are now publicly available.
And there was also a previous incident on Blanket Hill where Norman drew the gun, supposedly, and pointed it at students.
Yes, and if you watch the footage, you'll see he was being chased by a student who said, "Stop this man, he has a gun." And that's when he approached the guardsmen and the police officers from Kent State.
And then this happens in a larger context. It's like one leg of, you know, of a four-legged creature that's in motion. On the international scene, UN, what was it, the Human Rights Committee, with Laurel Krauss and others, you have this admission by the U.S. that something bad had happened, and they used the word murder, if I'm not mistaken, and there's now this international process that was set in motion.
It's clear these students were murdered or targeted by the authorities. There's no doubt about it. What's interesting is shortly after the students were assassinated by the Ohio National Guard, Norman went on to become a police officer in the District of Columbia.
Wow.
He was later prosecuted, and I have this file on the webpage. He had SWAT training and such, but he quickly got a job with the D.C. police. And then later he got involved. He was working with he and his current wife, who was also indicted. They came up with this false billing scheme, and he was indicted for mail fraud and such, and actually did time in a federal prison. I tried to get his mugshot from the Bureau of Prisons, but I was denied access to that. But he lives right now in North Carolina outside a national forest. When the FBI initially denied my request, I sent him a letter. And I also wrote his attorney down there asking if he'd be kind enough to sign what they call a certification of identity form, which is a release. He initially refused my letter. I found a way to get a letter to him, but I haven't heard a peep from him or his attorney. Now, two of the police officers involved in this matter are deceased, Harold Rice, and right now the other name escapes me, but their names were redacted on some of these documents, and the case law is clear. You can't redact the names of
a dead person,
deceased individuals. Also, the Akron police officer, Van Horn, he's deceased. So they're going to have to turn up those that information or any records where they're mentioned. That'll have to come, released publicly without redactions. Yeah. Also, if you look at the documents that were provided, it was clear the FBI was providing Norman with film and such, but yet we never received any photographs or copies of photographs. So the FBI is going to have to explain what happened with that information. Also, if you look at the court filings, David Hardy, who's the chief of the FBI's disclosure section, indicated that some records were destroyed, but he doesn't indicate when they were destroyed and the date, or the authority under which the record destruction took place. So I brought that up, and we'll see how the FBI responds to that. Also, there was talk of a subfile A, which I wasn't given access to, and there was a Cleveland informant file that I don't believe they provided. So the government's going to have to come up with explanations regarding this material. And that'll be up to the court to decide whether or not this is important or how they want to handle that. The other thing is they've redacted the names of Smith and Wesson employees and other FBI agents and so on. But the case law is pretty clear. If the public interest in the information outweighs the privacy interests, the material has to be released, and the FOIA exemptions are permissive, not mandatory, which means just because information falls within one or more exemptions doesn't mean the government has to invoke the exemption. So I believe the the public interest in these records outweigh any privacy interest. So even if some of the individuals are still alive, the public interest in this material is great. So I would note that we submitted affidavits not only from Laurel Krauss, Alison Krauss's sister, who was assassinated on May 4th, 1970, but we also have an affidavit from Tom Grace, who was shot on May 4th. And we also have an affidavit, and Tom incidentally lives here in Western New York. And we also have an affidavit from Brian Wheedling, who's working on a documentary about Kent State. When he was a student in Boston, he made a short film. So the reason these two affidavits were submitted to show that there's still great interest in what happened.
And finally, let's say that, okay, you get through, either you get a favorable decision now at the trial court level or on appeal if you go that way, and the information is released and it demonstrates what it appears it will demonstrate, that in fact, this was murder. And there was a settlement of the civil issues. I don't know if that can be revisited, probably not. There's no statutory limitation. There's no statute of limitations on capital crime, and murder would be one. Is there still criminal exposure for people if someone is still alive? It can be demonstrated, in essence, committed murder?
I believe there could be some exposure, but I think it would be very difficult. I don't know who the attorney general or DA is. That would be in Kent, Ohio, which is just south of Cleveland. I don't know if we could get them to take action, but if nothing else, letters could be written. Or again, I think it's important to put the public spotlight on this issue, because the more things change, the more they stay the same. This type of activity is still going on. If you read the recent Guardian article, you'll see the Black Lives Matter movement was just riddled with informants. It was pretty fascinating. Activists were sending text messages and they couldn't understand why the cops were there. Well, they had been heavily infiltrated by undercover New York City police officers. So I think, if nothing else, it's important for matters such as the Terry Norman / Kent State issue to be focused on now, so young activists can learn about what happened and how they can avoid some of those pitfalls.
Michael Kuzma is the plaintiff in an action against the U.S. Department of Justice on a FOIA request that seeks to expose information about the Kent State killings in 1970. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
We are sitting with Laurel Krauss from the Kent State Truth Tribunal, who is the sister of Alison Krauss, one of four students murdered, according to the government's own words, by the U.S. government on May 4th, 1970 at Kent State.
What was really great about Michael Kuzma's findings, or what was released by the FBI, is we got 177 pages of really great information that we had, some of which we had no access to before. It also has a lot of dates that we were never privy to. And it's more of a putting the puzzle pieces together because of the stonewalling and this whitewashing and whatever they're doing. It seems like they're putting more effort toward that than actually ever, providing us with the truth and historical accuracy about what has happened in these major events in our world.
What do you have in mind going forward for your organization?
As we look forward, our sites are targeting 2020, which is the 50th anniversary of the Kent State Massacre. And we're hoping to have a plethora of major truth to release to the public and actually tell the truth story about Kent State and Jackson State and how these domestic battles in the Vietnam War affect our world today.
That would be very important. Laurel, thank you very much. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.